Today, a vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, and incarceration traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. And many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate these problems rather than alleviate them. It's clear as we come together today that too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason.
If you've been listening to our show for any part of the last two decades, the words you just heard wouldn't surprise you. We've been highlighting problems with the United States criminal justice system, from prison overcrowding to racially biased sentencing disparities to overzealous law enforcement on the streets that serves as a funnel into the prison pipeline. But in August of 2013, the person who stepped up to a podium and said,
"As it stands, our system is in too many ways broken,"
surprised even us. That person speaking was the very man at the helm of that system, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
Even though this country comprises just 5% of the world's population, we incarcerate almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. Widespread incarceration and unwarranted disparities are far to come, both ineffective and unsustainable. School-to-prison pipeline. People of color often face harsher punishments than a minor school disciplinary offense should put a student in the principal's office and not a police precinct. We cannot simply prosecute or incarcerate our way to becoming a safer nation.
Speaking to the American Bar Association's House of Delegates, Holder went on to detail many of the same problems that activists and advocates have been shining a light on for years.
As the so-called war on drugs enters its fifth decade, we need to ask whether it and the approaches that comprise it have been truly effective. And with an outsized, unnecessarily large prison population, we need to ensure that incarceration is used to punish, to deter, and to rehabilitate, but not merely to warehouse and to forget. Today, a vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, and incarceration traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. And many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate these problems rather than alleviate them. It's clear as we come together today that too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason. It's clear that at a very basic level, the 20th century criminal justice solutions are not adequate to overcome our 21st century challenges. And again, it is well past time to implement common sense changes that will foster safer communities from coast to coast.
It's too soon to gauge the effects of Attorney General Holder's announced policy shifts, but the list he laid out that day was impressive. It included eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug crimes, releasing more elderly and nonviolent offenders from prison, and offering drug treatment and community service as alternatives to incarceration. And the overall message was that a long, painful era of policies that claimed to be tough on crime, but really did more to destabilize communities at tremendous public expense, might be coming to an end. If history bears that out, 2013 may be seen as a watershed year. And while federal policymakers might end up getting the credit, the real work has been done by grassroots organizations, the formerly incarcerated, and even those inside prisons and jails who've been advocating for years to be seen as human beings deserving of rights and respect. Today we're going to hear about a couple of such campaigns that saw big gains in 2013, the Movement Against Solitary Confinement, and a movement for phone justice, a campaign to eliminate exorbitant phone rates for calls out of state and federal prisons. First, reporter Christina Onestad has the story about the movement to end solitary confinement in the country's biggest incarcerator, California, and across the entire United States.
Come find out about the reality of what a shoe cell looks like. This reality is hidden.
Larry Everest has helped set up a mock prison cell in the middle of San Francisco's Justin Herman Plaza for tourists and other passersby to come take a look.
Prisoners are human beings. No one should be tortured.
Everest is a member of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, one of several groups working to end the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. He's standing in the mock 7-by-11-foot prison cell with a latrine.
These cells have no access to sunlight. There's no natural light there, and there's no meaningful human contact in the isolation cells where there's just one prisoner.
It's a tomb.
Stephen Sifra spent 4 years in solitary confinement as a juvenile and 4 more years in solitary as an adult in Corcoran State Prison and Pelican Bay State Prison's SHU, which stands for Security Housing Unit.
No expense was spared in sending the message that this is a tomb, basically. You're in your cell by yourself almost all the time. And once a day, your cell opens remotely, and then you can walk to another cell. It's open remotely. You enter that cell, the door closes behind you, and that's your yard.
We don't have solitary confinement here. We segregate right. These men.
Ralph Diaz is the associate director for the Department of Institutions at Pelican Bay State Prison.
We can hold 2,112 men in here. There's 1,200 men right now housed in our SHU unit.
The windowless cells in the SHU are small, 8-by-10-foot rooms, and inmates are forced to stay in there 23 hours a day. But Diaz downplays the effects of long-term isolation.
The inmates will go out to the yard for exercise for an hour and a half a day, so when they exit their cell, they go out to the yard, they'll stop by, talk to other inmates, they'll pass a magazine to them, they're communicating with each other up and down all the time.
The debate over whether solitary confinement is humane is not new.
No pictures.
Long-term use of the technique is particularly controversial. In 2012, the Center for Constitutional Rights picked up a lawsuit filed by a Pelican Bay inmate claiming SHU policies violate the 8th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Jules Lobel is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and lead counsel in the suit.
To put people in small little cells with no windows, no phone calls, no programming, no real recreation, and keep them there for 20 to 25, 30 years is torture. It's mental torture. It shouldn't be allowed in a civilized society, and the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and inhumane treatment.
They want the lawsuit to apply to all SHU prisoners who have been in solitary confinement for more than 10 years. The suit also claims the SHU violates the 5th and 14th Amendment rights to due process of prisoners who are serving indeterminate sentences in the SHU.
15 days is the limit that the United Nations has said that any one person should be in solitary confinement.
Marie Levin's brother is Pelican Bay SHU inmate Ronnie Dewberry.
And my brother has been in for 29 years. 29 years. Let me say that one more time. 29 years.
It's cases like Levin's brother where inmates spend years or decades in solitary confinement that are helping convince lawmakers and the general public that the use of solitary may have gone too far. Margaret Winters is the director of the National Prison Project with the ACLU.
In 2010, the Maine Department of Corrections made isolation a last resort, and over the course of 18 months, the state reduced its solitary confinement population by 50%. At the end of 2012, the trend continued. Illinois permanently closed TAMS Correctional Center, the state's only supermax prison. In 2013, Colorado closed a 316-bed supermax unit after cutting its solitary population by one-third.
Winters was speaking to a legislative hearing in California, held in the wake of a massive hunger strike conducted by over 30,000 prisoners in California, Oregon, and Washington in the summer of 2013. When the hunger strike ended after 2 months, only about 100 prisoners were still refusing food. But one prisoner died, and the strike got loads of media coverage. As a group, the inmates had successfully exposed the conditions they were living in and the need for change.
Ever since there has been solitary, prisoners have resisted the use of solitary.
Isaac Ontiveros, an organizer with Critical Resistance, a nonprofit prisoner rights advocacy group, says the movement to end solitary confinement has been prisoner-led.
Prisoners started filing lawsuits Prisoners started taking up peaceful protests. Prisoners went on hunger strike.
But a three-prong approach, which includes nonviolent protest, legal action, and legislative appeals, is supported by community groups and family members.
Unity inside. Unity outside.
Their overriding demand is a demand for the end in California's use of indefinite solitary confinement. They have no idea when they can get out. They can be held there for a year. They could be held there for 40 years. It is indefinite. That is their primary demand. Kind of all their other demands are under that envelope.
Prison officials in California aren't budging just yet. Ron Barnes is the acting warden at Pelican Bay State Prison.
But I do believe that there's a legitimate reason why we have the security housing units. I believe it's a success for the department, and we need to maintain them.
But policies in other states are changing. In 2013, Nevada passed a bill limiting solitary confinement in juvenile facilities. Similar bills were introduced in four other states, including California and Texas. Illinois closed its only super maximum security prison, TAMS Correctional Center, this year. Here's Illinois Department of Corrections spokesperson Tom Scheer.
We feel that we can do things right without a supermax facility. We also save $65 million a year in operating costs. But we wouldn't try to achieve those savings if we felt that safety and security were compromised. Safety and security have not been compromised. In fact, they're actually better now. The incident of serious assault in Illinois prisons is down 35%, and the downward trend continues. So we feel that we can do everything the public expects with safety and security, both in prisons and for the public safety, without a supermax facility.
As the use of solitary confinement in prisons is beginning to wane, the underlying belief in crime and punishment is shifting too. In 2007, two murders and one suicide in Mississippi's supermax prison prompted a lawsuit by the ACLU. Instead of defending the unit, the state's Department of Corrections Commissioner Christopher Epps shut the facility down.
If you put them in the cell and you treat them like animals, that's exactly the way they're going to behave.
Since the 2010 Supermax closure, Epps has reduced the rest of the state's solitary population by 80%. Speaking to CBS News, Epps said the state prisons now offer numerous programs for high-security inmates.
Mental health programs, anger management, adult basic education, trying to get a GED, alcohol and drug, because they are coming back to you in my neighborhood, whether we want them or not.
Unity inside! Unity!
That recognition that solitary is not only cruel and expensive, but doesn't help prepare prisoners for life on the outside, is helping transform the way the issue is framed. With mounting pressure from the public, prisoners, lawmakers, legal advocates, and inmate families, states are beginning to change the isolation practices within their prison systems. For Making Contact, I'm Christina Onnestad in California.
Every time we come down here, we are making history.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa.
Hi, I'm Linda Sudak from San Francisco. I really appreciate the variety of voices, the young activists who have so much energy and knowledge, and that gives me lots of hope and inspiration for our future. So thank you, Making Contact. Keep connecting all those dots, and I'll keep listening.
To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
Hey, George, it's Andrew.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. So we're working on this criminal justice show, and supposedly you're working on a story that's almost done?
That's right.
What's it about?
Well, have you ever heard something like this?
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I've heard that.
So in this part of the show, we're going to be hearing about prison phone justice.
Prison phone justice?
Up until this summer, there was almost no regulation of the cost of prison phone calls. To find out more about what happened this year, I gave Alex Friedman a call.
Hi, this is Alex.
Alex Friedman is an associate director of the Human Rights Defense Center and has campaigned for years for prison phone justice.
Essentially, prison phone justice is ensuring that people who are incarcerated have the ability to make affordable phone calls to their families and loved ones outside of prison. And likewise, people outside of prison have the ability to communicate by phone at reasonable rates with their family members and loved ones who are incarcerated.
I know. This is a very significant day, so take your time.
Okay. My name is Bethany Frazier, and I'm honored to address the commission today on the issue of prison phone rates, as it has personally impacted me and my
Bethany
family.
Frazier is one of the millions of people in the U.S. with a family member inside prison.
I am 36 years old and the mother of two young boys, aged 5 and 10. Their father has been incarcerated for the last 2.5 years, and my kids are among the 2.7 million children with an incarcerated parent in the United States.
At a hearing of the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, in August 2013, she explained how the high cost of phone calls affected her family.
Losing their father to prison also meant losing an income while gaining a painfully large phone bill. As you vote today, I would like each of you to know that I would do anything and pay any amount to keep my children connected to their father. But choosing between essential needs and keeping kids connected to their parents is a choice no family should have to make.
The high cost of prison phone calls meant many families were having to make that choice, and they wanted the FCC to do something about it.
On a monthly basis, these phone charges exceed the amount of my grocery and electric bill combined. Under the current rate system, without caps or reduced fees, my family struggles to maintain the ties that will keep our family connected when my husband is released, and this is the same for 90% of all incarcerated people.
How much you have to pay varies from state to state. For example, in 2012, there was a $4.95 connection fee for a prisoner in Washington state to make a call to someone in another state. But for a California prisoner, the connection fee for the same kind of call cost a dollar less.
So, Alex Friedman, we've been talking for about 2 minutes. Give us a sense of how much this call would have cost if it had been made by someone from inside prison.
Well, if you were calling from within a prison, and this was, say, a long-distance call from one of the states that has some of the higher rates, you'd be looking at a $3.95 connection fee plus 89 cents a minute. So for a two-minute call, you'd be looking at about $5.73.
It's actually cheaper to call Outer Mongolia than for some prisoners to make a call to someone inside the U.S., and remember that these companies have a captive market.
Well, they don't really have to justify it. And the reason is because these companies have monopoly contracts. Once they get the contract, they're locked into one company. People don't have the option. Prisoners can't decide, oh, well, I'd prefer to use AT&T as my provider or Bell South or what have you. They're locked in. They have no other options once these companies have the contract.
We tried calling Global Tellink, one of the main companies involved in the prison phone industry.
Hi, my name's George Lavender. I'm calling from the radio program Making Contact. I'd like to speak to someone about the cost of prison phone calls.
But they declined to comment on this issue. Because the prison phone providers are private companies, we don't know exactly how much profit they make from each phone call, but it's safe to say that it's a lot.
Two of these companies, Securus and Globaltel, are owned by private equity firms. And you can see when these firms sell these prison phone services among themselves, they transfer them or sell them off between different equity firms. And they sell for hundreds of millions of dollars when they trade hands. So there's no doubt these are extremely profitable companies, mainly because of the very high rates that they can charge, that until just recently there was virtually no regulation over those charges. So they were kind of printing their own money by charging these very high rates for prison phone calls which again, if prisoners want to speak with their family members or vice versa, there are no other options. They have to pay the rates.
The prison phone market as a whole makes $1.2 billion a year. Family and friends of people inside prison, as well as former prisoners like Alex Friedman, have been working for years to try and bring down the cost of prison phone calls. The Prison Phone Justice Campaign recorded some of their testimonies.
Hi, I'm calling today because sometimes I cannot talk to my son for months at a time because it is so expensive to speak to him because of Global Tellink, which is the company that they use at the correctional center that he is in Virginia.
My experience with the criminal justice system or with the prison phone system is a nightmare. I had a loved one in prison 10 years ago, and I could not believe the costs. It's extortion. It's somebody that's stealing money from some of the poorest people in our country.
So it needs to be reformed. It needs to be changed. It needs to be affordable for families, so that they can talk to their loved ones that are behind bars. Just because a person is behind bars doesn't mean they stop living.
Stories like this one were used to put pressure on the FCC. Again, Alex Friedman.
There's been a variety of different ways where people have tried to challenge this very unfair business model where consumers were being price gouged and they really had very little recourse.
Lawsuits were filed.
Largely, lawsuits were unsuccessful trying to challenge these high phone rates.
FCC actions were filed.
That is formal complaints or petitions for rulemaking with the Federal Communications Commission.
And a whole campaign was mobilized around this issue.
That brought together people, stakeholders, organizations around this issue and pressed them to take action.
And that brings us up to a hearing of the FCC in Washington, D.C. in August of 2013.
Madam Chairwoman and Commissioners, the next item on your agenda is entitled Rates for Interstate Inmate Calling Services.
It was only after the campaign got involved in starting applying pressure to the FCC that the FCC finally decided to act.
Thank you. For 10 years, family, friends, and legal representatives of inmates have been urging the courts and waiting for the FCC to ease the burden of an exorbitant inmate calling rate structure. Their wait is finally over. Borrowing from a 1964 anthem inspired by the challenges of his time, the immortal songwriter Sam Cooke sang that it's been a long, long time coming, but change has finally come. Today's
been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
That was acting chair of the FCC, Mignon Clyburn. The agency ordered a cap on the rates companies can charge for phone calls.
And provides immediate and meaningful relief, particularly for low-income families.
Basically, the order hits several high points, one of which is it creates an interim rate cap, which basically says that the companies that provide prison phone services have to cap their costs to a certain amount. And initially, that cap is 21 cents a minute for debit and prepaid calls and 25 cents a minute for collect calls. So that caps the cost of a long-distance call to about $3.15 for a 15-minute debit or prepaid call and $3.75 for a 15-minute collect call, a significant reduction from some of the highest rates that we saw among the states in the prison phone industry. A change gonna
come. Alex Friedman welcomes the FCC's decision, but says more needs to be done. He points out the cost of many prison calls are still 5 times higher than the average phone call for people outside prison.
We do not believe it goes far enough, but we're encouraged that the FCC is seeking additional proposed rulemaking. We think this is a very good first step with the FCC's current order capping the rates and providing guidance to the companies on what they can charge for prison phone calls and so on. But it's just that, it's a first step. Certainly more action is needed.
And all this is assuming that the FCC ruling stays in place. Prison phone companies have indicated that they will try to challenge the new rules. Still, for Alex Friedman and other advocates, it's a step in the right direction. For Making Contact, I'm George Lavender.
What I think is changing is that there's just a real awakening of consciousness in so many communities around the country.
Michelle Alexander is author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
To see people who are formerly incarcerated finding their voice and beginning to organize in large numbers, and seeing the hunger strikes behind bars where prisoners themselves are asserting their own dignity, I feel hopeful that we are turning a corner and that the work that's been done over the past 35 years or more is ultimately going to help manifest the kind of movement that will help to remake America in a way that would make me and I think many others feel hopeful and proud.
If one of America's leading critics of the prison industrial complex has hope, then perhaps the system can change for the better. It remains to be seen if and when Attorney General Eric Holder's words will help transform attitudes in Washington, in state capitals, and in law enforcement agencies across the country.
Now, we must never stop being tough on crime, but we must also be smart and efficient when battling crime and the conditions and the individual choices that breed it. Now, ultimately, this is about much more than fairness for those who are released from prison. It's a matter of public safety and public good. It makes plain economic sense. It's about who we are as a people, and it has the potential to positively impact the lives of every man, woman, and child in every neighborhood and city in the United States. Today, and together, we must declare that we will no longer settle for such an unjust and unsustainable status quo. To do so would be to betray our history, our shared commitment to justice, and the founding principles of our nation. This is our chance to bring America's criminal justice system in line with our most sacred values. This is our opportunity to define this time, our time, as one of progress and innovation. This is our promise to forge a more just society. And this is our solemn obligation as stewards of the law and servants of those whom it protects and empowers to open a frank and constructive dialogue about the need to reform a broken system.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Omnia Foundation for helping support this show. And for the segment on phone justice in prison, thanks to the Media Democracy Fund and the Media Consortium's Media Policy Reporting and Education Project. For a CD copy of this program, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, George Lavender, Nancy Lopez, Quan Booth, Dan Turner, and Barbara Barnett. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.